welcome Radhika and Alan to the Wharton India Economic Forum podcast series.
Thank you.
Hi.
And we were debating who we should have on the podcast series this year, and your name was top of the list. And I told the organizers, look, they are both extremely busy. To have them both together, despite their busy life, is going to be very tough. But look, I'll send them WhatsApp.
Uh-huh.
And Nalin accepted in 55 seconds, and you accepted in 2 minutes.
See, all for the love of you.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, as preparing for the podcast, Radhika, obviously, you've spoken a lot. Nalin, you've done a few as well. I wanted to sort of find areas where you guys haven't spoken on topics in the past. And we wanted to sort of create this podcast series from the eyes of a student, a Wharton student, undergrad, grad, somewhere in the world, trying to sort of learn from your successes and your disappointments and your life experiences. So imagine I'm a Wharton student asking you questions, or any grad, undergrad student asking you questions.
You still look young enough to be a Wharton student.
Thank you. Thank you. And as just to start, I mean, the plan was to read out a long profile about Nalin, long profile about Radhika, but I guess the world knows you guys really well. But maybe to summarize, you're now a shark, and you swim in the open waters and open seas, so I don't know how this works. But let's start with a topic which I don't think you guys have talked enough, and I know you guys are really proud about being from UPenn. I remember my first interaction with both of you when Amrita and I came back from UPenn. We did a potluck.
Yeah.
And those were the days when people did potlucks. And I met you guys, and you convinced me to become co-president of the UPenn Club of Mumbai. So talk a little bit about your UPenn journey. Why are you guys UPenn proud? About that topic.
I think UPenn is a big part of both of our lives. I'm sure Nalin will also speak. One, we met at UPenn, and incidentally, in our graduating class, nearly every Indian who went to UPenn married another Indian who went to UPenn. Not that that's a sales pitch for UPenn, but coincidentally, a lot of our close friends ended up being from UPenn, and I think we still get together because everyone's married to each other. We're going to go out together, and we're all talking UPenn stories and when we were 18 and 19. So I think UPenn in any way has been a very big part of our lives. But at least for me, I think UPenn was a dream. I said this when I won the Alumni Award earlier this year, that for a middle-class kid in India at that point, going to any US college was a dream. And, you know, an institution like UPenn absolutely was. I think it's been responsible for changing my life, certainly. You just get to see the world at a very different scale. You develop an immense self of self-confidence. And I really think everything that has followed, at least for me, has followed because of UPenn. So you remain very close to the school in any way that we can.
And
of course, it makes you feel a little younger.
Yeah, you guys have given a lot to the school. You've been president of the Penn Club of Bombay, come to so many of our events, Nalin. You've given time as well. And talk a little bit about your UPenn journey and, you know.
So apart from meeting Radhika, Aditya, Penn has played a really pivotal role in my life. To give you a sense, when I graduated, my first boss was a Penn alum.
Okay.
Radhika and I started a business with
a
third Penn,
Penn alum.
Our first Series A round of funding was led by Ramanan, who was a Penn alum.
I also worked for a Penn alum.
Interesting.
Many of our initial clients were Penn
alums. Penn alum, yeah.
We have had Penn interns for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And I've actually led Penn admissions in India for the last 15 years now. And I've had a chance to meet and mentor so many young kids, current students, recent alumni, and just having that network has been one of the biggest blessings.
As a student in UPenn, how does one maximize what Penn has to offer? I mean, I remember going to school and there's so much to do, and one can get lost in the opportunities that one can access. How's student life? How do you maximize your time there?
So maybe I can share how some of the best current students are maximizing Penn. and they use what I call a T framework. They're really deep on one or two things, either academically or, you know, extracurricular.
Right.
Taking advantage of the very best that Penn has to offer
right.
in both fields. But then they also round that out by sampling various other things from the menu.
Right.
So I give the example of Harsh Meswani, who's class of 2021
yeah.
from Penn. He was an M&T student. He also sang for Penn Masala. But he's dabbled in so many other things. He's a runner like you and me, you know, and I think he's had the best all-round Penn education.
Amazing. Yeah, and I think Penn is actually about carving your own Penn experience because there's no model Penn experience. Of course, you have to. I mean, I agree with Nalin completely. You know, whatever academic bit you choose, you have to go really deep into it. The only thing I would add is that, you know, you can pick even, you know, something like M&T, which both of us are, of course, very close to. But even within that, I think Penn offers so many classes. And one thing you realize 20 years after working is that you'll never get that classroom yeah. experience again.
Yeah.
So outside of just doing the hardcore Wharton or the hardcore engineering classes, sample some really interesting stuff because you're just never going to get that. I mean, I nearly finished an English minor
right.
and I remember taking this class with this guy called Robert Strauss, which was writing about humor.
Wow.
And you had to read essays and you were judged on how funny you are.
Wow.
And I'm so glad I did things like that. But Penn is really about crafting your own experience and picking a couple of things and going deep into them, as he said. But really, they should be owned. Now, whether you choose to do Penn Masala or whether you choose to run a magazine or whether you choose to start a restaurant or whether you choose to be a TA, I think that's a choice you make.
So prioritize inch wide, mile deep. But dabble in a few things outside your comfort zone.
And do
zone.
Your yes. own thing. Do what yeah. works for you, I think.
Yeah.
Make it your own experience.
Actually, it's interesting you say that. I did a public speaking course.
There you go.
Then, outside of the normal Wharton campus. I later realized there was a half semester tabla course
yeah.
at UPenn, which I missed doing, and that's a big regret.
Huh.
Apparently, there's a half semester course on the book War and Peace.
Interesting.
And have you tried reading War and Peace? Like 800-page
no.
book. So you can't read it. I've tried multiple times. I've stopped in the middle. You sit in the class. You're assigned characters. So like you're Boris, you're Svetlana, and you read the book as if you were the character.
That's super cool. So I would have done that.
Yeah. I only knew about it later on. So if there are Penn students watching, they should do some of these classes.
Yeah,
if they still exist.
You really should.
Yeah. But I think the point is right. Prioritize and dabble in a few things. And then moving to your entrepreneurial journey, right? It's now a trend for kids to start things out of school. It wasn't as much when you guys did it, but now it's a thing. At least our class had Warby Parker, we had Paperboat, we had Allbirds and Harry's come out of our class. But how is your entrepreneurial journey? And again, students coming out of college, it's a tough time.
Mm-hmm.
They have loans to pay and mouths to feed. And how should you think of doing the safe thing?
Mm-hmm.
Versus something that you are really passionate about?
So I think we have a saying in Edelweiss. Is it worth it and can I afford it?
Mm.
And that's a great framework to look at this, you know, entrepreneurial question through. Because one is that, do you have the risk appetite to start something? Do you have a good idea to start?
Right.
But entrepreneurship is very personal, and you also need to have the right circumstances to start a business. So, for example, if you do have significant student loans, if you have certain liabilities, then maybe today isn't the right time to start, but a few years hence, maybe.
Yeah, I would add a couple of things to what Nalin said, and I think the crux of it is having the right idea, but look, you know, we've done the entrepreneurial journey, but there's almost a belief today that if you're not going down an entrepreneurial journey, you know, you're a slave to someone else, you're taking the easy route. And I don't think that's the case. I think having been entrepreneurs now, building a business, you know, in a bit of a bigger setup, I think entrepreneurship is not about ownership. It is about adding value and building value. And you should focus on that. You know, there's always some trend on campus. Like at our time, I think banking was the cool thing to do. Now running a startup, I don't think you should chase cool. You should chase what works for you, what works for your circumstances. And everybody really has different circumstances. The other thing is, there's no hurry, right? You know, so there's no hurry to drop out of school or just finish school and become an entrepreneur. You have your whole life. You have a 40-year career ahead of you, maybe more actually. So there's no hurry that I have to join the startup race and if I don't do it today. Now, if you have a really great idea, as Nalin said, maybe it is the right time for you. And if your circumstances can afford it, maybe it's the right time for you. But, you know, time's not running away. At 21, time's not running away, for sure.
And, I mean, there's a bit around people wanting to follow their passion versus people having certain duties, right? And I was actually talking to somebody at ex-colleague 70th birthday. You know, I guess once you turn 70, you have a halo and you realize certain things. And he mentioned that, you know, what I've realized is people ask me this question, why I'm on this earth? What is my purpose in life? Should I go down a route around, you know, what I'm passionate about? And his answer was, look, if you're doing in each part of your life what you were supposed to do, what's your duty towards yourself and others, you've lived a full life. So when you're young, you're a student, your duty is to be a good student,
yeah,
get good grades. When you join your first job, your duty is towards your job and what they expect of you. And when you get married, your duty is towards your family. And then when you grow older, your duty towards your parents. And if you live your life like that, you're doing fine. But now people want to go down the route of passion, what they're really maybe keen on. Is it for everybody?
I think it isn't for everybody, but it's for many more people than currently are pursuing the path of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the risks that we think about in our mind aren't actually risks.
Yeah.
And I was talking to one of my young mentees who's a recent Penn graduate earlier this week, and he wanted to start his own fund,
right,
like we did. And I told him, so he was asking me, what if I fail? And I told him, you know, actually everybody expects you to fail. The default assumption is that you will fail. So surprise us by succeeding.
Interesting. That's an interesting insight. And people obviously put a lot of, again, from a student's perspective, they put a lot of emphasis on the first job out of school.
Yeah, way too much.
You guys joined Goldman and McKinsey, and, you know, people want the right brand, people want the right title. How important is the first job out of school? Should one focus on the company, the brand, the title, or should one focus again on the work you're doing, the boss you're working for, in this current extremely competitive world? Does it put you back?
So I've talked about this and I've written a lot about this, and I don't want to be judgmental because, you know, it's very easy for either of us to say we started at Goldman and McKinsey that the first job doesn't matter. And I think you have a completely different perspective at 40 than you do at 20.
Yeah.
And I would say both of us are certainly the better for working at Goldman and McKinsey. I mean, I'm sure Nalin will say he got a lot out of his Goldman experience and I got a lot out of my McKinsey experience. But I think we put a lot of emphasis on brand and we put too much emphasis on starting salary, which in my view doesn't really matter because what you're going to earn in compensation at 21, it just doesn't matter. You're going to earn a lot more later in life. I think the people you work with are extremely underrated. So your experience at McKinsey will not be shaped only by McKinsey the firm, but the partners you work with, the team you work with, and that is true of any organization. I think campus talks a lot about culture, but all of us dismiss culture in, you know, on-campus recruitment.
Yeah.
And I think finally, you'll realize tech was the right culture for me, or banking was the right culture for me, or McKinsey was the right culture for me. So I think we should not underestimate cultural fit. And I think finally, job success. Most of us, our careers are a mix of chance and choices, really.
Yeah.
I think
most,
some amount of choices and hard work, but also some amount of chance. And when we look back on our 20-year career, the first job mattered, but it's not the end of the world.
And at 40, you realize that, you know, it's all about people, people, people.
Yeah.
If you're working with the right set of people, every job is going to be tough. You're going to be working late. You're working late with good people, I guess.
But there's a word that Nalin has, which I really like. And he says that you should not be a prisoner of pedigree. You want to explain that?
Interesting.
Right. So this is again a reflection of speaking to many, many of my mentees.
Hmm.
A prisoner of pedigree is somebody that went to a great undergrad school,
yeah,
worked at a blue chip first job, maybe went to a top-notch MBA afterwards.
Then got another great job.
And then suddenly you're in your late 20s and you hit an air pocket because you don't know what's next. There is no right path. You have to think for yourself.
Yeah.
So it's very, very important to reflect upon what is your North Star and then work accordingly.
Yeah. I say it's not collecting pedigree, but it's collecting experiences.
Yeah.
Experiences with people, firms, things. Experiences. Be experience rich, not pedigree.
How do you find your North Star? Like, how do you do that? I mean,
so I'll give you my example.
Yeah.
At Penn, I studied computer science, finance, and statistics.
Yeah.
And I was very keen that my first job out of college involved a substantial amount of all three of these aspects. I also wanted a place where I could learn. Mm. In another life, I would be a professor. But I wanted a more academic environment. So while I did end up working for Goldman, I didn't look at their sales and trading or investment banking arms, which were the popular choices at that point in time. Mm. I went to work for a team called QIS, or Quantitative Investment Strategies, in their asset management business. And it was a very cerebral place. We had Friday lectures.
Interesting.
We never worked weekends. There was pin drop silence on the floor. It was like being in a PhD program in finance, except that you were being paid rather than having to pay tuition.
Amazing.
So not everybody has that kind of depth of clarity, but even if you can have a little bit of that, it will go a long way in helping you find your North Star.
So try many things and fail fast if you have to fail fast, and try and find your North Star. You've talked obviously a lot about Forefront Capital in the past and how you've scaled that business. You scaled pretty quickly from 2 crores to 200 crores, and then you sold it to Edelweiss and got acquihired.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not very standard
for
somebody scaling that quickly and growing it so fast to sell into a bigger platform.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you take that decision? You see a lot of companies now, startups, entrepreneurs, becoming sunicorns and unicorns and then, nothing-corns, I guess. Why do it so early?
Yeah, look, I think it's very circumstantial, but there is, to your point, there's a lot of selling, especially for us, I think a lot of people, because we hadn't even worked in India, in my case, not even lived in India, there was a lot of, don't sell to a bigger platform. But we felt in financial services, a bigger platform would give us capital, it would give us scale, it would give us brand. And the fact is, it's been the deal was done in 2014. We're sitting here in 2023. We're still here. So there was probably something very good that came out of the deal.
Yeah.
And I think when you start to look at such deals as partnerships, not a sell versus buy competition, you can really build something that adds value. There was recently one, Tanishq and CaratLane.
Yes.
And that's a transaction that has created a lot of value for both parties. So I don't think you should look at it as the, a lot of people scared us about doing the deal. And finally, my view is you have to do what is right for the business at that point in time.
Get rich slowly. If you try and get rich.
Focus on building value.
Correct. Any reflections for you, Nalin?
I think a lot of credit also goes to Edelweiss as a corporate.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Rashesh and Venkat, who are the founders. They have allowed the business to blossom.
Mm-hmm.
They have given both of us fantastic opportunities along the way. And Edelweiss is a very entrepreneurial place.
Very.
So it has felt like a natural extension of running a startup. And I think that is what has kept us here for almost a decade.
And so you guys didn't start your startup to sell. You guys started your startup to build.
Yeah.
To build. And build an institution that obviously outlives you guys, hopefully. And
well, Edelweiss Mutual Fund, which has been built in the last 6-7 years after the acquisition, has been a startup. It's been, I mean, it has all the qualities of a startup. Not an established brand, didn't have money, which is something that startup founders struggle with. In fact, less capital than most startups have because they're well-funded. And is competing in a very competitive space. So it's been built as a startup from ground zero and within this umbrella. And to Nalin's point, in India, it's very rare to find places where entrepreneurship really blossoms like this.
Amazing. I'm glad you guys got that opportunity. And it's a great segue to the next question, right, Radhika? To you, you've traveled so much length and breadth of the country, met different people from different walks of life, different cities, different backgrounds. You've kind of championed the cause of mutual funds and SIP. And I wasn't doing much SIPs until I started hearing from you. So I do SIPs now, and
thank you.
I hadn't done Bharat Bond until I heard a lot about it, and then I remember we exchanged messages, and none of my wealth manager were actually selling that product, and I had to kind of almost force them for me to buy it, and at that time I'd put 25% of my investable capital into Bharat Bond. It's done really well for me.
Thank you.
But just talk a little bit about your experience of building this business for India and for Bharat and for people around the country. How do you guys go about building this business for different people from different walks of life?
So I think I've learned so much in the last 7 years of literally roaming the country. And as I said, I've never lived in India. So everyone thought with my background, how am I going to be roaming around for Bharat? And you know what you said, you're a consumer of Bharat Bond, you're a buyer of an SIP. And a person sitting in a small city in Assam can also be a consumer of Bharat Bond and do an SIP. So actually, there is no difference in building for Bharat and building for India. My belief is good financial products are ones that solve problems for consumers. And consumer problems are very common. I want to save and create wealth for the long term. I want something where my money is safe and mujhe every type kuch mil jayega. I want a tax-efficient solution. I want thoda sa badhat or growth and thoda sa bachat, which is risk-adjusted return in fancy Wharton language.
Yeah.
So I think building financial products is about solving consumer problems. And in our product committees, finally, we go down to the question, are we solving a real consumer problem? And do we have the ability to do this well? And of course, will we make money doing it? So I think that's been the experience. That's why I think something like Bharat Bond has been incredibly successful.
It's become huge now, right?
It's huge. It's 60,000 crores in size.
Wow.
And it's possible. It's a very successful public-private partnership. And what has it done? It's taken an FD product that Indians were so familiar with and moved it on a mutual fund platform and said, I've given you a range of FDs from 2024 to 2037, you pick and oh, they are liquid and tax efficient. So I really think finance and financial services is about solving consumer problems and communicating them. One of the things I'm learning as I hang out with more consumer businesses is also communicating them very simply. Institutional finance has a very complicated language, but I always say nobody wakes up thinking I want to buy a flexi cap fund today. I want to buy a passive fund today. People wake up thinking that this is my need with my money. Money is a goal to solve a problem. Let's change the language of communication.
Nalin and Radhika, you guys can obviously help me think about my investment choices. And you had mentioned, right, that for a person working in equities and investing, you shouldn't have all your eggs in equities. You should invest in some fixed income product. I remember that conversation. And then a few weeks later, I've invested in Bharat Bond. So it was, thanks for that advice. But segue into Nalin, you're part of the business. You know, you've been investing in India for 10, 15 years, you've been investing in equities. How has that changed in the last 10 years? Has it gotten easier? Has it gotten more difficult? Is stock picking now harder because many more people are doing it? How has been your experience?
So it's gotten easier and harder.
Hmm.
It's gotten easier, Aditya, because there is so much more information
right.
available. So today, for example, there is a free resource like screener.in where you can go and download financial statements and do analysis of any of the 5,000 listed Indian businesses. So access to information has been completely democratized.
Mm.
But it has also become harder because now, in order to make money, you need to focus on a longer term time horizon. Mm. And you also need to focus on more of the qualitative and intangible aspects of a business. Mm. So that is the change that I've seen over the last 15 years.
And what's your process? I remember us talking many years ago when you were running Forefront Capital, where you guys are an algorithm. It spat out four names. And you've taken the example of L&T, I still remember from that conversation. And then I'd asked you saying, look, if it spat out L&T, do you then do more work on L&T and then invest in it or just directly make the investment? So your point was, whatever the algorithm spits out, we'll buy it, we'll see whether it works or not, and then change the algorithm, but not kind of do more work on the name itself. It's a little bit of like this Dhoni school of management, right? Dhoni talks about how a win or loss in itself doesn't mean anything, but the win or loss tells you what to change in your process. And hopefully then there'll be more wins when you change the process for the better. But what's your process when you think about investing today? How do you pick stocks?
So our process has certainly evolved.
Of course.
Over the last 10, 15 years, Aditya. And at our core, we remain very rigorous, very analytical, very data-driven. But there is an important element of human judgment that goes into understanding a business, understanding market dynamics, understanding a competitive landscape.
Hmm.
And I think today we combine both, great quantitative and qualitative rigor across all our funds at Edelweiss. That is, I think, a cornerstone.
Interesting. And maybe, Radhika, moving to your part of the business, right? You're in a market which is extremely competitive, lots of big players, lots of Indian businesses, PSU-owned assets, global asset managers.
Yeah.
How do you find a niche? When I think about savings, a savings product like a mutual fund versus a lending product, I would take a loan from anybody.
But you wouldn't give money to
But
them.
I would not put my savings product in anybody.
Yeah.
And for people, most of their savings historically have been with SBI and HDFC and, Tatas and so on and so forth. Right? How do you then compete in that market where there's a lot around trust and long-term kind of performance?
So I think you make a great point, and people often don't appreciate, I was sitting with some other folks in the context of Shark Tank only, and they were like, we run consumer businesses and yours is a fund. I was like, mine is the greatest consumer business there ever is, because I'm not selling toothpaste. I'm selling actually trust. I'm not even selling a product. I'm selling a promise of future returns. And my consumer, when he buys an Edelweiss mutual fund product, his relationship doesn't end with me. His or her relationship starts with me. And that's when the judgment starts. And to your point, I think trust is a cornerstone of this business. And yes, there are very large players who not only have trust, they also have reach. So an SBI will have a branch on Assam border, on Meghalaya border, where I just can't hope to compete. And the other thing is, I think it's easier to build a niche. So you said find a niche. I think it's easier to build a niche business. Look, I'm this small asset management player who's damn good at merger arbitrage, or I'm really good at small caps. And I'm very clear, we don't want to build Edelweiss Mutual Fund as a niche. And today, as a 1 lakh plus crore player in the top 12, 13, we are not niche. So the journey has been to build a scale asset manager in this heavily competitive market. And the answer is a few things. Product innovation has helped, but there's a limited amount of innovation I think you can do in a highly regulated platform because products have to be simple, but certainly it did help get our way in the door. Bharat Bond was a very successful example. I think distribution, 80-85% of our business is distribution. We don't come with bank-to-bank distribution.
Yeah.
But believe me, I think it's an edge because it makes you work harder. So I always say the mantra for Edelweiss Mutual Fund is, in Hindi we call it chappal ghiso, which is that you just work harder.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no answer. You do more outreach, you're more involved with your partners because it just matters more to you. I think many years ago in the US, Avis had an ad,
yeah.
You know, because we're number two, we have to work harder, we have no choice in that. But I think chappal ghiso has been an important mantra. Communication is a place where you can be very innovative. So I think of us as a very innovative new age brand in terms of our communication strategy, in terms of our social media strategy. And finally, time, right? Trust is built over time. It's built with track record, communicating track record, how you manage down cycles of performance, I think is one of the best ways to communicate trust. How you deal with customer grievances, are you out there? The trust is built over time and value is built over time. I think we live in a world where people are perpetually in a rush to build a unicorn.
Yeah.
In financial services, great institutions take time to build.
Right.
HDFC didn't become HDFC in 2 years. It took 20 years to get that golden age of
trust. It takes 20 years to become an overnight success.
Yeah, so it takes, and in financial services and in asset management, the point you made about lending is bang on. In asset management, it takes time. Time adds the golden touch.
How do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it innovative? How do you innovate around products? Do you guys sit in a room? Do you guys listen to your customers? Do you see what competition is doing?
A lot of customer engagement. Mm. I think the worst, we're not blind to what competition is doing, but the worst thing I like to hear is, this is how it's done in industry.
Mm.
In fact, stepping back from industry, as long as you're focused on solving a consumer problem, you will do well without complicating. I also don't like the word innovation too much because innovation means complexity.
Mm.
So it has to be simple. It has to be first to market. And communication is a place where you can do a lot of innovation.
Fantastic. Nalin, would love to hear your thoughts on 2024. You know, the 2020X series has been a tumultuous series of years, starting with COVID and, you know, unfortunately now the two hot wars that are going on, geopolitics, and every year throws some span in the works. 2024 looks to be set up nicely for India with what's happened with elections, what's happened with the some sense that the Fed has given around rate cuts. And generally the economy is doing well. We thankfully don't have a recession risk. We don't have an inflation risk. We don't have an interest rate risk. But how do you see this year panning out? And how should, as an investor, one should think of this year?
So I think, Aditya, you rightly summarized it as saying that India is sort of this island of stability and growth, you know, volatile and uncertain world. My advice to all investors is to not think of a single year at a time, but to think of it in maybe 5-year blocks or 10-year blocks. And I think Radhika has a great saying that the stock tip of the decade is actually a stock called India.
Yeah.
And if I can just share one piece of investment advice, it would be that.
And you
So I keep saying, do an SIP into India.
I guess all of us are through mutual funds doing an SIP in India. Given all of us work in India, we are invested in India.
Yeah.
But obviously there are, you know, left field risks that could impact us. Where do you see the big risk factors for India 2024?
So I think the biggest risk that India has over the medium term is actually hubris.
Hmm.
It is thinking that we have already made it, thinking that, you know, we haven't, that we are carrying everybody along with us, thinking that growth can come at the cost of the environment or social issues. These are the things that will hurt us in the long term.
Fair point.
And it's really important that we have inclusive and sustainable growth in the next decade?
Yeah, I think hubris is an important point. I think it may be a question for Radhika on, you know, Amrita and I, we have two daughters.
Uh-huh.
They're growing up in a world where it's, I wouldn't say it's getting easier for women in the workforce, but it's definitely different from 10 years ago and 20 years ago. A lot has to do about, you know, where they're growing up and the upbringing and the role that parents play, especially in, you know, bringing up daughters. Mm-hmm. And so just your experience and your reflections of your life and, you know, other successful women you have met as parents, what would be your advice?
I have met so many women now, because we often have these forums, women's awards, and by the way, contrary to what many men think, most of us love each other and are really cheerleaders for each other. I think it is, we should bring up our daughters to believe that it is going to be tough for women. The fact is, at least in my generation, I don't know about your daughter's generation, but unfortunately I think so, we will still be a minority. We will be that only women CEO or that smaller group. So it is always going to be tough. We will have the load of work. All of that will happen. I mean, no woman who rises, I think, has it super easy. So we should bring up our daughters to be tough. But we should also bring them up to know that it is getting better with each progressive generation. The family, spouses are becoming much more involved. Like Nalin is a super hands-on father. My parents are, ever since I've had a son, so helpful and so supportive. So the family structures are getting better. It's also important for us to ask for help from our partners. Half the time we bring up our women to think that you have to carry the load on your own. Why should we carry the load on our own? And the third thing is for women to truly be ambitious at the workplace. I still think, and I keep saying this, I still think Indian women lack incredible amounts of ambition. And I'll tell you a story that I haven't told. I mean, it just happened to me yesterday. And this is where I think the change is happening. I was coming back from Bangalore to Mumbai, and I was sitting on this flight. I had the aisle seat, and, you know, a man told me that he's going to change the seat next to me, which is the middle seat, because another girl has seen me on the flight and wants to sit next to me because she runs a business in handloom sarees, which is something I've been talking about.
Interesting.
And she knows I'm captive on a flight for 2 hours. So she wants to talk to me about it. And she spent 2 hours talking to me, and she came to meet me. And we struck an equation, and something will come out of that equation. That I didn't have that confidence when I was 25 years old, despite going to Penn, by the way.
Yeah.
That is the change that
Interesting.
Girls, and that's how I would love to see a girl being brought up.
So the challenge is your own kind of perspective.
Yeah. The glass ceiling is as much in your head as it is in the world.
And in my job, I have mentees.
Uh-huh.
A couple of them are women mentees, and I've made them my reverse mentors. Because the age difference, by the way, is like 15, 20 years now. So for me to really know what young people are thinking, what should we do for them at the job, how do we motivate them, retain them? You know, I need mentors who are 20 years younger than me. So we have this mentee-mentor relationship. And I'm asking one of my younger women mentors, you know, what do we do today at work, and what could we do better to make your life easier? And the answer from her was, actually, don't change anything. And please don't make it easier, because you guys are doing a good job at keeping it equal for everybody.
And just keep it equal.
And I was like quite taken aback by that answer. So, you know, pretty positive answer. But, you know, girls who are 12 today, girls who are 14, like my daughter is 12, what would be your advice to them? Keep pushing yourself hard.
Keep pushing. I wrote this in my book. And I think my advice is find your sky, whatever it is.
Right.
And it doesn't need to be the same one. And teach yourself to fly.
Right.
And you do need to teach yourself to fly.
And should parents, you know, help kids get to their passion, let them be on their own, drive them a little hard? Like, what's the right mix.
So, and Alan should comment on this because of admissions also he sees. I'll give you my perspective, but I think he should comment because he sees so many parent-child relationships because of admissions. I think you have to find a balance, right? Our kids are growing up in a more abundant India, and we have to find the balance between giving support and giving so much support that they become fragile.
Yeah.
And I think with your and my, our generation of parents, that's a little bit of a risk. So we have to also teach our kids to fall and fail and get up. But of course, give them the support that all our resources allow. I mean, you have a perspective on this.
So I see so many talented high school seniors who are applying to Penn, Aditya. And I think the one blessing that the successful ones have had is that their parents have given them the full backing to pursue one area of excellence, whether it is traveling overseas for a Model UN conference or getting the best squash coach or, you know, being able to compete in a robotics competition. There is, you know, I think the successful parents are the ones that are saying, okay, my kid is interested in this, he's good at this, so let me give him or her the best resources in that particular area.
And interestingly, I was talking to a current Indian badminton star, Saina, and you know, I was talking about her and her life and how did she achieve so much, and I was naively asking about, you know, our kids and can they really become superstars in sports, and her point was, if you don't scold them enough, they will never get anywhere.
Exactly,
and
so that's my point her about parents fragile were like, children.
Yeah, and but I heard somewhere else that, look, you come from adversity, and you'll, and there are lots of examples, people have come from adversity, done really well in life, and the childhood was an adversity, but I'm sure there are some positives of being children in growing up in abundance, right? You have a mindset where nothing is impossible, and you can probably achieve anything.
And you can
anything.
Take a lot more risk because you're not worried about what Nalin said, you know, on campus, the consequences of failure. You don't have that student
There is some
loan.
Safety net for you.
There is some safety net. I think the key is to, my father always says that each generation should take a leap because it should realize the opportunities that it has versus the previous generation. So as long as there's gratitude for the opportunities that you have, you should take
a
leap.
That's a great point. Moving to another topic that both of you are, you know, quite focused on, thinking about and speaking about health goals. And I'm not just talking about physical health, mental health, financial health. You know, Nalin, you've been on your health journey doing marathons and Ultramans and Ironmans and whatnot. So what kicked you off on this journey?
So, Aditya, I started running, or I would just rather say I started walking in the end of 2016.
Right.
I was 33 at the time, and I was 86 kilos, very overweight, terribly out of shape, and I couldn't even climb a flight of stairs without feeling out of breath.
Wow.
And I thought to myself that this was heading down the path of disaster in a few years' time. So I started by signing up for my first half marathon, the what was then called the Standard Chartered Mumbai Marathon, and walked most of it, but I've been hooked and I've been following this journey ever since then. And I think also the pandemic in particular has taught us, Aditya, that you can have as much success or as much money as you can ever have.
Yeah.
But if you don't have health,
yeah,
that is the foundation of everything. You know, finally, if you were out of shape and couldn't get oxygen, you probably didn't make it through 2021.
Yeah. And have you learned something about yourself through this journey, your health journey? I kind of feel it's very therapeutic to, you know, you run a half marathon, you run full marathons, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, you're with your thoughts, right? Is it therapeutic for you? Is it? Have you learned something about yourself?
So the tagline of Ironman
is
anything is possible. And I love that phrase because that phrase tells you is an optimistic phrase. You can achieve anything in life. Anything is possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a pessimistic phrase because it tells you that anything is possible. Anything can go wrong. Anything, be prepared for the worst outcome. So I think that is my biggest lesson in life that I've taken from my dabbles with sports.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. You have to keep that, you know, option alive where you achieve something really awesome at the end of your marathon, half marathon, that you surprise yourself in a way. And moving to sort of mental health, and Radhika, you've talked about this topic a lot. I sometimes feel that when you're really busy at work, to balance physical health and, you know, going for runs or going to the gym, balancing mental health, being present at work, being focused at work, is just hard to do everything together. And there are times when I've actually ignored my physical health to focus on my mental health, such that I'm prepared for work, ready for work, you know, ready to deliver 100%. How do you kind of balance out work life, the hectic nature of your work, and mental health and physical health?
So I think just as perhaps we discovered in COVID that physical health was important, you know, COVID was a very tough time for mental health for people. In fact, there's a stat I read somewhere that about 25%, one in four people in every office is grappling with mental health issues. And I did a talk in 2018, you know, which became reasonably popular, but where I talked about my struggles with mental health, especially on campus. And to me, the answer has been to be more open in conversations about it. We all know so many of our classmates who struggled with mental health on campus because they didn't get a returning offer or they didn't get the job of their choice, or they weren't dating the girl of their choice, and that carries on into the workplace and that carries on into our family life. And really my answer has been to be open about it, because once you are open to the issues, and the world is a super judgmental place, look, you know, I mean, I can only give you lists of the stuff I deal with online. The more you're open in talking about your issues and your vulnerabilities, which Indian society sucks at, the better it is for your own self-confidence. And really, I mean, I keep telling people on the floor, you have a responsibility towards your work, but you also have a responsibility that if a colleague is grappling with something, can you be there to listen? And can you also share when you need to share?
That's important. So this is the last section. It's a bit of a rapid fire.
Do we get a hamper?
You will.
We get a hamper.
And anybody can answer any of these questions. Just pick and move on. Dealing with trolls. How do you guys? Do you guys have trolls? How do you deal with trolls?
Okay, I'm going to answer that because I have like 5,000 trolls. This is the biggest troll sitting here. He likes to troll me, but I deal with him. You know, there's a block button.
Right.
There's a mute button.
Right.
And we used to have trolls when we were kids. Like, we had a random uncle saying she's too fat. So
right.
I think trolls have made me stronger.
Right.
And sometimes I laugh at them. Sometimes I block them.
Do you engage with them or do you just ignore them?
I have engaged with trolls a couple of times. When I feel that the troll is saying something and my responding can make a meta point. Like, I get trolled a lot on my looks, especially my squint and neck and etc. So that's something I've engaged once or twice. I got trolled for writing a book while I was a full-time CEO. Okay, Satya Nadella will not get trolled, but Radhika Gupta has to get trolled. So I responded on that. But literally, you can come to me and say, Radhika, you are a horrible person and you are super ugly and incompetent.
Right.
And it will not affect me.
Right.
So I'm cool. Thank you, trolls.
Yeah. Your experience, if at all?
Do you get trolled?
Very few people troll.
Nobody trolls them.
But I think, ignore to a large extent.
Delete, mute, laugh.
Yeah.
And this, on a serious note, I think one advice is, everybody gives their opinion, decide whose opinion matters and on what. So I know that for work, XYZ people's opinion matters to me. And in my personal life, XYZ people's opinion matters to me.
Right.
The rest is noise.
So drive strength from it and move on.
Yeah, let's move on.
70-hour work weeks, what's your mantra in life?
I think it is important to work hard in your career, especially when you're young. So I am actually in Mr. Murthy's camp. And I think it's not about doing it for your country.
Right.
It's about doing it for yourself.
Right.
Yeah, look, I made some statements on this, and
right.
I got trolled and non-trolled. But I think you're the biggest asset you have when you're a young person and we're in the asset management business is actually your time and talent, and
yeah.
you should max it out.
Yeah.
Now, some people take this in different ways, and it doesn't have to be 70 hours. And it's not work for the sake of work, right? You should enjoy it. You should do it because you're learning and enjoying,
yeah.
and then it will not seem like work. Yes,
yeah.
but you should work hard when you're young. Yeah, it's
yeah.
simple.
What else are you doing?
Yeah.
And
you should enjoy doing it. I mean,
absolutely.
Nobody is forcing you to do factory labor. Yeah,
absolutely. Do you
guys and of course, you'll be paid for it.
Do you guys have mentors? Do you guys have formal, informal mentors? Have you guys sought out mentors?
Nalin, you want to start?
I do. I look up to many of our older Penn alums.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been a great sounding board for me.
Mm. And I see this kind of Penn being omnipresent in all our lives, right?
Yeah.
And I just feel... For me, even a week doesn't go by until I meet somebody from Penn or Wharton, either having a meeting or conversation around something. And so, you know, utilizing that network is important.
Yeah, I don't have mentors as much as I have informal advisors. I like to call it personal advisory board.
But one should have that.
Yeah, you definitely need that. Especially
yeah.
as you get older, you certainly need that.
If you had to have a dinner with a person from, you know, current or past... who would you pick? Who would you want to go out with?
Okay. So, past Atal Bihari Vajpayee.
Oh, nice.
I admire the man, the poet, the statesman, and to be in opposition for that many years and then lead the country as a statesman. Oh, God. Current, the list would be longer. Let me pick three.
Right.
Three people I really like. Nandan Nilekani, for I think the way... He's contributed to both the private and public sector. Shah Rukh Khan, because I love Shah Rukh Khan, not for his movies, but for the persona he is. And Dr. S. Jaishankar, our current foreign minister.
Of course.
For the way he's changed foreign policy and the way he can demolish you without saying a word.
Yeah.
By just his eyes. I think it's phenomenal.
I think they are all these people are setting the new standard for strong and positive India, right?
Yeah.
Nalin?
So, one of my personal heroes is Eliud Kipchoge.
Okay, of course.
Who is the Kenyan marathon
159.
Runner. And apart from his amazing track record of excellence, his two gold medals at the Olympics, he still leads a very humble and low-key life in Kenya. So, I think there is a lot to learn about character and discipline from somebody like that.
And I guess... one can actually go to Iten and live with these runners and train with them. I guess there's a 3-4 week camp one can do.
You can theoretically do that, but nobody can physically keep up with these guys.
Of course. If you weren't doing what you guys were doing today, what would be something that you may be doing? Or if you weren't managing
money
or if you weren't investing?
I would probably be writing/speaking, although I'm doing quite a bit of that today.
Yeah.
Or I would be India's tourism minister, if they let me be one. Because I'm super passionate about tourism and textiles.
Amazing.
I would run Olympic Gold Quest for India.
Lovely.
Because I think it combines my love for sports, for India, and for working with young people.
I actually recently met... Viren and the whole team, and they're doing an incredible job.
They're doing very good work.
And we have the 2024 Olympics coming.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, and we will surprise people in Paris.
Yeah. I really think we should. And we will. Do you guys still read books? Do you consume more podcasts? How has that changed for you guys? Are you book lovers or...
I was a huge fiction reader.
Right.
But now with our son, Remy... time is much shorter, so
right.
it's a little more podcast content.
Yeah.
I also think the visual form, because I keep working on executive presence and speaking, and I think
yeah.
some of these things really help. So a lot of podcast content, poetry content. But yeah, I was a big reader of fiction and poetry, still do it, but books are a little tougher.
I'm reading a lot of books.
Yeah.
The only difference is that they are children's books.
Huh.
So I'm reading The Gruffalo.
Yeah.
I'm reading...
You're reading one every day.
Reading...
That's
the
therapeutic
the
as well, by the way. Reading books to your kids, so...
So I'm reading a lot of those books. I do listen to a lot of podcasts. My favorite one is The Huberman Lab.
Sure.
And...
Very technical.
Very technical, but I love his stuff.
Yeah.
Tried to implement a few of his protocols, but a long way to go.
And maybe last question. How do you guys decompress? I mean, you guys... live hectic lives.
Mm-hmm.
You have Remy in your life now. How do you take me time out? How do you decompress?
So Remy is my decompression.
Sure.
He's 1.5 and you've had kids. And he is adorable. And
yeah.
he is funny and he's entertaining. And we snuggle with him and we play with him and we run after him.
Yeah.
So all decompression points.
Kids grow up very quickly, so...
All decompression
enjoy.
Today
yeah.
for me points to Remy. Like, he can make me do things that nobody else can do. Nalin thinks he's fully manipulated me and wrapped me around his finger. It's probably true.
It is true.
Yeah.
And I would agree with Radhika that he is our love and joy. And I cherish every minute that I spend with him. Even if it's the small stuff, like giving him a bath, or
yeah.
cleaning his diaper, or putting him to bed,
yeah.
or reading The Gruffalo, and or The Cat in the Hat to him. I think there's a lovely saying that when we look back, we'll realize that it was actually the small things that were actually the big
yeah.
things.
By the way, Julia Donaldson was in Bombay few years ago. She had done an event at some bookshop. So yeah, I'm sure she'll come back again. But
awesome.
Look, you guys have been phenomenal. Thanks for doing this with us. It's my first rodeo, so really enjoyed talking
you
to you.
You did a good job on your debut.
Fantastic job.
Yeah.
Thank you. Maybe it's a post-P career
yeah.
option for me, but yeah.
Maybe you'll become a big content creator and make millions doing podcasting. Do remember to give us our 2% royalty then.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Aditya.
Thank you,
Aditya.
Thank you.